Hey, this is Mark A. Altman. I'm here with Ed Gross.
Hello.
For our new podcast, The Last Starfighters. And we're really excited because this week is a week after the release of our latest book, So Say We All, the complete, uncensored, unauthorized oral history of Battlestar Galactica. Try saying that three times fast and you win a set of steak knives. Well, Ed, I'm so thrilled because, you know, you and I have been working together on and off intermittently for many, many years. And, you know, this book is probably the culmination of a lot of what we've done over the years. It's really a remarkable book about a subject that we both love. And, you know, before we get into the book, it's such a great story. I mean, how you and I first met. And of course, you're on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast. You say tomato, I say tomato. But how do we end up first collaborating? I think it's a fun story. I may be the only one.
Well, no, I mean, back in the day, you were writing, you had Galactic Journal going, your own magazine. I was with Starlog, you were writing for Cine Fantastique, we were both covering Star Trek, and it was just reaching out to each other, and the idea came up of, hey, you have Star Trek material, I have Star Trek material, why don't we collaborate on a book?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was still a teenager, I got a call from you, I was still living with my parents, and I'm like, Ed Gross from Starlog? Oh my God, what does he want? And you had talked about having access to some material I was doing for a project you were doing, and you know, many years later, we ended up deciding to write a book together, and that turned out well. And then, of course, we, you know, starting in 2016, we did the best-selling 50-year mission series about Star Trek, which was remarkable. But we're here to talk about Battlestar Galactica. And, you know, it's funny because I feel like our decision to do a book about Battlestar Galactica has its roots in, ironically, 50-year mission at Star Trek.
Well, it does. I mean, especially the second volume where we were talking about the making of Voyager. And a lot of the material dealing with Ron Moore briefly getting involved in that show and what he attempted to do with it and the discussions of his frustrations between he and Brandon Braga and Rick Berman and how that ultimately led to the creation of Galactica. And it also led us to say, hey, wouldn't Galactica make an interesting book?
Well, it's funny. I remember it slightly differently because I remember I got all these great quotes from Weddle and Thompson in particular about Battlestar Galactica and the birth of Battlestar Galactica and what made Battlestar Galactica, you know, an edgier version of Deep Space Nine. And I kept trying to wedge it into the book, you know, so there would be these long passages in the Deep Space Nine section.
Which I kept cutting out.
Which you kept cutting out. And it finally, I'm like, this is great material. Why do you keep cutting it out? And you're like, yeah, but it has nothing to do with Star Trek. And I said, you know, you're absolutely right. And I think it was at that point that in the back of my mind, I was like, man, we got to do a book on Battlestar Galactica, because if this is tangential to, you know, that these guys gave us, there's got to be so many great stories. And of course, it's interesting because both you and I come to our Galactica fandom from different places, whereas I love the original series. You know, you're not a fan. It doesn't hit you the same way it hit me.
A fan, but not a diehard fan, because I was 18 when the show debuted, and when I watched it, it was kind of like the hokiness elements of it struck me that back then, as opposed to being a kid where you're kind of enamored with everything.
Yeah. That's fine. I don't know why you would say there's anything hokey about the original Galactica, but if indeed, you know, you want to insist that that's the case, you know, that's okay. You go ahead and say that. But
okay, yes, thank you.
But I'm not going to agree. So listen, here's the thing. I mean, yeah. I mean, I grew up when Battlestar Galactica premiered in 1978. I was there. I remember watching it. And, of course, Jimmy Carter announcing the Camp David peace accords in the middle of it and interrupting, and much to my chagrin. One of the things about this book that I feel was so satisfying was the chance to sort of shine a light on the original Galactica, which so often was the Rodney Dangerfield of sci-fi, not getting any respect. And I think we showed, you know, whether you like the show or not, why it's a significant piece of of television. It was the most expensive show produced for television at the time. It came in the shadow of Rich Man, Poor Man and Roots, which were huge miniseries for ABC. And it was just an immense, immense undertaking. ABC, even though they canceled it after one season, deserves kudos for even putting it on the air in the first place. And of course, it evolved from being a long miniseries to weekly episodes. And I think that sort of unfortunately sealed its demise pretty early. But I got to tell you, I mean, I think in the process of writing this book, we came across some really interesting things that no one had ever covered before. Ironically, it was when you were talking to Stephen D'Souza for another book that we found out that he had a tangential connection to Battlestar Galactica.
No, absolutely. He was witness to some of the discussions between Glenn Larson and ABC and the frustrations, and they were fighting them back on you know, you can't kill so many of these Cylons, you can't kill them. You know, they're, you establish that they're lizard people, and then it was said, well, they're robots. Oh yeah, they're robots. Okay, you can kill as many of them as you want.
Well, I love, you know, when he talks about being there when Glenn Larson was served the lawsuit. And he mentions, he says, this lawsuit's ridiculous. They're suing you over twin sons, and they're suing you over the use of robots, and they're suing you over laser guns. I mean, these are all staples of science fiction, you know, for 100 years. And Glenn Larson said, really? And he said, look, I'll go get, you know, the science fiction encyclopedia. And he shows him these pictures from these classic pulp magazines and realizes that the iconic, you know, the iconic images is, you know, sort of, you know, staples of the genre. And then you have, you know, he says to his secretary, go out and get this book right away. and the sad thing is that, you know, D'Souza sort of confirms that as a result of the lawsuit, they started going crazy, sort of cutting out anything that could be potentially problematic in terms of the lawsuit. So a lot of the aliens were cut, you know, because of the cantina similarities, quote unquote. A lot of other elements, you know, were sort of brutally, you know, trimmed in the edit, you know, to avoid any chance of there being a crossover with Star Wars. And then, you know, most people don't know this, Universal countersued Fox over the similarities to Silent Running and Buck Rogers in Star Wars,
right.
And which is probably just as valid a suit as suing Galactica Universal over the similarities to Star Wars. I mean, there's no question that the original Galactica was influenced by Star Wars in the sense that it probably would not have existed had there not been this wild success of Star Wars. And certainly the ships bear a striking resemblance, largely because Ralph McQuarrie also worked on Star Wars. The visual effects supervisor, John Dykstra, also worked on Star Wars. I mean, he pioneered these techniques. So, of course, there are similarities. But ultimately, Galactica is much more of a downer. I mean, the entire, you know, race, human race has been wiped out, and, you know, they're looking for a new home, being chased by these Cylons. And of course, you know, it's about family, you know, the Adama family of Apollo and Adama and Marion Jensen. I say that with a smile, even though this is an audio podcast. But you know, Ed, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, they say, oh, Ron Moore, I hate this expression that the 2004's Galactica name only is an expression these fans use, who for whatever reason hate the new series. You know, Ron was actually a fan of the original show. He grew up on the original show. So I think there was a lot of respect there. And of course, like many people, I was not a huge fan of the miniseries, but boy, when 33 debuted, they had me for the next 4 years. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the influence of the original Galactica on Ron Moore and the birth of Galactica 2004?
Well, I mean, you know, look, Ron, as you said, was a fan of the show. He grew up with it. He grew up with, you know, Star Trek, Galactica. Those shows really had an impact on him. Basically, and you know, when he was first approached about the idea of doing a, you know, this new version of Galactica, he wasn't too into it until he went back and watched the 3-hour saga of the Star World. I mean, and that to him, because it was the aftermath of 9/11.
The aftermath? What's this have to do with the aftermath?
No aftermath, sir. I never said that. Aftermath of 9/11, it took on a new resonance for him. It suddenly took on a new meaning. And when he sat down to start really thinking about this and working on it, he recognized it was the feeling that we all had after that day where it was like we were fighting for survival. Even if we weren't, we felt like we were. And that was the inspiration for him to say, all right, how do I translate that and put that into space? And Galactica felt like a natural to him to take it that way and in that direction. And suddenly that allowed for a much deeper character-oriented Galactica than the original was ever allowed to be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of the fun of the book for me, too, was the fact that here you talk to people like Aaron Douglas and James Callis and Jamie Bamber about their first experiences with the original Galactica as kids, which is interesting because a lot of, I think, fans, you know, they think there's this huge rivalry or that somehow the people who made 2004 just have the utter disdain for the original Galactica. And that's not quite the truth. They have many of the same feelings, you know, that I think that fans of the original Galactica have. And of course, you know, Galactica 2004 has really become one of the great television series of all time. It took risks that we've never seen in another science fiction show, you know, and along with The Twilight Zone and the original Star Trek, I think it really stands as perhaps one of the great genre shows, you know, ever produced for TV. And that's really a testament to Ron Moore and this amazing writer's room that he forged over the course of doing that show. Why do you think Galactica 2004 is such a monumental achievement, Ed?
Well, look, it came at a time still, you know, in the era, like I think it was the very beginning of Sopranos and that sort of thing, where people were just, it was allowing a television to grow up, essentially. It was one of the pioneering shows that really engaged in serialized storytelling, despite all the fights with the network about serialized storytelling. And it allowed for characters to be flawed, to be very human, to fight with each other, to just explore the darker aspects of humanity. And it was a show that, for that reason, more than anything, I think, was one that appealed to people because it was just so different than anything we'd seen before.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like, you know, obviously Galactica 2004 is not a perfect show, but, you know, it was really reinventing the wheel and reinventing the paradigm of sci-fi shows. So you need to cut it some slack in a sense, because it was truly boldly going where no one had gone before in a sense, with the serialized storytelling, the documentary, a visual style, you know, the sort of really dark and edgy characters. I mean, Deep Space Nine had sort of tentatively explored some of these arenas and done it very well at the time, but Galactica was really taking it to another level, you know, and yet there are things that certainly could have been improved. I feel, you know, the miniseries suffered from sort of a lethargic pace. I mean, a part of that had to do with the fact that Ron, after he wrote the miniseries, was really disengaged because he was a show running Carnival at the time. And then, you know, I just think there were some bad decisions made later on. I mean, the new Capra arc, which is arguably, you know, the highlight of all four seasons, was only a couple of episodes, largely because the network didn't want to do a space show on a planet where they said, this is, you know, Battlestar Galactica is about a spaceship in space. It's not about people on a planet. And, you know, originally the writers had wanted to do a whole year on New Caprica, which I think would have been amazing.
It's amazing that you almost felt like the network wasn't watching their own show because they were criticizing it. They were saying, oh, the audience doesn't want this, ignoring the fact that they were doing some amazing storytelling on New Caprica. Like that somehow that was damaging the show, which was crazy.
Yeah, and you know, you think because you're building all these new sets, I mean, you have to amortize all this stuff over the course of the episodes. So how much more they could have done over more episodes. And, you know, I don't want to bore the audience, but, you know, that's kind of, you know, a staple of television. It's why, you know, you sort of have Enterprise in its final seasons doing these three-part, you know, mini arcs, because if you're going to build something expensive, you can sort of spread that expense over three episodes rather than one, where it's really not viable to spend that kind of money on one episode. I mean, it's part of the whole process of making the sausage, as they say. You know, when you look back at the New Galactica, you know, what are some of the highlights for you? What are the episodes that really resonate that you look back and say, you know, this is what made it great?
Well, look, the things that really stick out to me is, of course, 33 is the one everyone goes to because it was just so shocking and how good it was and how powerful it was. The Kane storyline was amazing, but I hold on to things like the thing that really stands out for me, believe it or not, of the four seasons, as much as I love New Caprica and I love all this stuff, that mutiny arc in this final season, I found really powerful because I'd never seen a mutiny on a show where the power shift continually shifted. I mean, it went from the mutineers back to the good guys, back to the mutineers. And it was so powerful watching these characters who were the ones who allowed themselves to become mutineers on the ship and suffering the repercussions of that at the very end of it, you know, as Tom Zarek and the Geta. It just, to me, was really probably one of the most powerful arcs that they told on that show.
It's funny. I have to really agree with you because, you know, I feel that final season, there are things that are problematic for me. And I love the finale. It's not the finale. I have a problem when they go off on that ship with Starbuck. I feel like that sort of goes nowhere. I think that's you know, other than Gata getting his leg shot off, there's not much going on there. And, you know, the hostility towards Starbuck in general. I mean, I and then, of course, you know, I also had problems throughout with the whole Baltar Messiah, you know, the religion that springs up worshiping Baltar that somehow exists on board the Galactica, as though you could on an aircraft carrier suddenly have a bunch of religious wackos, you know, holding mass in a sort of, you know, a secret room off to the side that no one knows about. You know, that said, it also did some remarkable things like the mutiny, of course, and the finale with Daybreak. And, you know, I think that one of the areas that they tended to explore that was very divisive was sort of Cylon culture, you know, where they really did a deep dive in the Cylon culture. And if I had any problem with that, it was just that they really didn't have the budget to realize it. I mean, there's one point at which Six says, oh, we can visualize the Baystar as anything we want, but you know, it seems like apparently they visualized it as a Crate and Barrel or a Pottery Barn outlet store because you know, there was this sort of settee and these curtains, and it always took me out of the show.
Didn't
because
they do a tree, like a forest or something, like a short
yeah,
forest?
Yeah, but
that
then
was
they
it, though.
Abandoned that. It was sort of like a holodeck. And, you know, again, it's so easy to criticize, but I mean, you know, I'm basically 99% of the show was utterly brilliant. And, you know, I look back to earlier seasons, you look at an arc like the Pegasus and how they took what was arguably one of the greatest two-parters of the original series, that along with War of the Gods, and then, you know, put their own unique spin on it. So they both stand alongside each other as really remarkable, you know, remarkable shows. And we just screened both episodes at the, American Cinematheque. We showed Mission Galactica, The Silent Attack, which is a compilation of the Lloyd Bridges Living Legend episodes and Fire and Space, which sort of screws up the whole thing. And then then Razor, which was the 2-hour Michael Taylor telefilm that debuted at the beginning of season 4. And, you know, both versions are equally awesome of Kane and just brilliantly done.
They also show, I think, when somebody says, oh, they're rebooting something and everyone rolls their eyes and says, here they go, they don't have an original idea, they're rebooting it. But it shows you that if you're going to reboot something, this is the way to do it. Giving it its own edge, giving its own voice.
Well, I think by comparison, you could look at the way Star Trek redid Khan, you know, which is the antithesis of how to do it. You know, I don't hate Into Darkness the way a lot of people do, but, you know, they basically did sort of the same thing in a sense. And as great an actor as Benedict Cumberbatch is, and he's been brilliant in so many things, you know, there was no outside the box thinking, whereas obviously Michelle Forbes couldn't be any less like Lloyd Bridges, and yet she's as effective, if not more so, as this sort of classic character.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one thing I was going to say, one thing we have to talk about, because to me it's a highlight of the book.
What do we have to talk about, Ed?
I'm going to tell you what we have to talk about, Mark. We have to talk about Galactica 1980, because we kind of jumped into the new one, and we got to talk about that, because I'm shocked at what you were able to uncover on Galactica 1980.
Well, you know, Ed, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, I skipped over it intentionally because the less said about Galactica 80, the better. But no, in fact, it's a really interesting story in writing the book because, you know, as you know, we spend a lot of time on these books. But the Galactica book came on the heels of Slayers and Vampires. So we were really just putting the one book to bed. And then all of a sudden we had a whole nother book to write right away, which was fine because we were both super excited about it. But I sort of, you know, obviously being as dismissive as we are, Galactic 80, sort of wrote that chapter and finished the book and was really excited about the book and reread the book. And then I'm suddenly reading the Galactic 80 chapter and I'm like, you know, this doesn't have anything new to offer. I've read this kind of material before. Yeah, the show was terrible. Yeah, we all hated it. Oh, Return of Starbuck was great, but the rest of it was terrible. And then I was like, you know, no one's likely to ever write about this show again because it's awful and who cares? And I said, so I want to write the definitive coverage of Galactica 1980. And I went back and I literally erased what I'd written and started from scratch and interviewed a bunch of new people, tracked down a bunch of people who were still alive, and rewrote the chapter from the very beginning. And now I'm so proud of it because I just think it's a wonderful story. I think that story is a more insight into the gonzo nature of Universal Television in the late 70s, early 80s, where everybody, you know, had a wet bar in their office or was on drugs and, you know, basically, you know, just got jobs by who they knew. It was sort of this, you know, old boys club. And then, you know, you worked on shows you couldn't care less about. And, you know, sometimes you got your arms twisted and then working on something you had no interest in. And it's just an absolutely fascinating story. And to learn, you know, so many of the reasons why that show was bad, you know, one, of course, is they didn't learn the lesson of Galactica. They made the same mistake. They greenlit this three-part premiere, and then the ratings were good. So they immediately greenlit a series without the time to develop it. And so the episodes were put into production, you know, virtually immediately, and they're awful. And, you know, you have a censor, 7 o'clock, they replaced the Hardy Boys. So you could only tell stories that had educational content. So in the middle of a car chase, suddenly a character would start explaining what the internal combustion engine does and how it makes a car run. I mean, it was crazy, but that's what makes that chapter so gonzo. And then to hear, you know, what a jerk Kent McCord was to Robin Douglas. I mean, she was fascinating stories from her. And then, you know, Barry Van Dyke also, you know, who had been the original choice of the network for Starbuck. And, you know, I think Barry Van Dyke is one of the better things about Galactica 1980, but I can't imagine a worse choice for Starbuck, especially when you think the network was fighting a tooth and nail against Dirk Benedict. And, you know, it's funny writing these books because, you know, my day job is I write and produce and, you know, for television. So it really helps me to weather sort of sometimes studio and network notes because I have a sense of perspective on it all. So when I'm getting notes on something and I don't necessarily agree, it's funny. I think about some of the stuff that I've written about and some of the historical perspective, and it helps me deal better with, you know, ridiculous comments I may get on a pitch or on an episode of TV. And that's why I tend to be very mellow about the whole thing rather than other people who sometimes freak out when they get dumb network notes. You know, I'm just sort of like, okay, we'll figure out a way to do it or to convince them they're wrong without, you know, freaking out. And you know, so the books have been very educational for me, you know, as a writer, as well as, you know, as well as somebody just fascinated with the history of pop culture.
Absolutely. You know, what's funny, you brought up the thing about how they, you know, rushed into production Galactica 1980 and then right into series again. I remember years ago, I spoke to Ken Johnson about the making of the V miniseries, and NBC came to him and said, hey, let's do a follow-up, and they were going to do a six-hour miniseries. And then they said, let's go to series. He goes, no, the way to do this is like 5 or 6 two-hour movies a year. That's all you need to do, and V will run for 10 years. And they said, no, we got to do a series. And the same thing happened that happened with Galactica and Galactica 1980. It just went down the tubes.
Well, you know, and it happens time and time again. You have these things, these two-hour movies that are successful. Even something like Fantastic Journey on NBC, oh, yeah. You know, about the Bermuda Triangle. You know, they premiere these like 90-minute, you know, TV movies that are successful, and then they immediately, oh my God, we could have this success every week. But it very rarely works that that's the case where they do have that success every week. You know, and these things get rushed into production. There's no thought that's put into it and they don't work. And, you know, obviously television's changed dramatically since then. I mean, it's different now where, I mean, you look at something like Better Call Saul, where the writer's room, you know, can work for 10 or 12 months before they even go into production. So, but, you know, back in the old days, I mean, sometimes you would literally have, you know, a week. I mean, one of my favorite stories that Anne Lockhart tells in the Galactica book is how one day she's at home watching Galactica, and, you know, it's next week on Battlestar Galactica, and the clips or that they show the scenes were from stuff she shot that Friday, you know. So, I mean, that's how under the gun they were. And this is before nonlinear editing and post-production was all digitized. And I mean, people talk about, you know, CGI and all that. That's, you know, how that changed the business. But, you know, the whole process, things used to be cut on film and had to be delivered and mixed. Now everything's mixed in Pro Tools, and you cut on a Avid or, you know, Final Cut Pro. I mean, that has changed the ability where literally you can be finishing stuff at the last second. But back in 1979, 1980, I mean, you were still cutting on film and mixing and, you know, sending it via satellite to your network affiliates. And I mean, I don't know how they did it. It's remarkable. And I don't think that's anything we can really even convey in a book, is the sheer magnitude of the accomplishment of what these shows. And so when people look back and say, oh, it's stupid, it's silly, or it looks cheesy, it's like they have no sense of context for, you know, the question is, how is the show bad? The question is, how is the show so good?
Right.
That to me is the question that you really have to look at. And that's why, you know, taking us back to the original Star Trek, it's such a monumental achievement because it was so ahead of its time and, you know, virtually every way. And why, and not, you know, not to get us off subject, I so resented the idea of redoing the visual effects, because I feel that the original effects on Star Trek that were done 66, 67, 68, 69, you know, we're so ahead of their time and remarkable to be able to do anything like that for television, that it's disrespectful to redo them. You know, what Next Generation did, because they had the elements, were able to do it, they basically recomped the stuff, which was fine because everything had been post-production, you know, post-production and video. But it was, you know, basically the original effects elements. Whereas with Star Trek, you know, the stuff was redone. And of course, most of the people who'd worked on the shows were dead. Now, they had some wonderful people who worked on it, and so it's no disrespect to them, but they didn't have the time or the money. And it's really unfortunate, because I feel like I always make a point of watching Star Trek with the original effects, because that, you know, that's, you know, what Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn and, you know, Mark Daniels and, you know, Pevney and all these people, you know, that was their, you know, what they signed off on. And that's what I want to watch.
I hear you. Yeah. It's all this talk though about the craziness of jumping into shows also reminds me of a story from the book too. Also is that Sci-Fi's reluctance to go from miniseries to series. It took a really long time for them to say, yes, we'll go to series. And the only reason they ever even did so was because they struck a deal with Britain that Sky, I think it was, would run the show first before it came to America, and gave them enough money where they felt comfortable going into production.
Yeah, people don't realize how close 2004 came to never happening. Yeah. I mean, it really looked as though, you know, the miniseries ratings were okay, but not great. The reviews were okay, but not great. Really, where the show Battlestar Galactica becomes what it is with 33, which, you know, just blew people away. And there's a remarkable story that Ron Moore tells you, in which it was the first episode he never wrote an outline for, never wrote a treatment, never broke. He just wrote sort of stream of consciousness, and it has that feel, and I think that's why it's so effective. But I mean, there were people, I mean, I'll admit it, like me, who watched the miniseries and were underwhelmed, you know, who watched 33 with an attitude of prove it to me, and boy, did they prove it to me.
They absolutely did, didn't they?
Yeah,
and they kept proving it after that. So that was
My God, that first season is so good. And then second season is even better. And I think, you know, third season is probably the high point. And then by the time you get to fourth season, you know, they you know, there are moments that are brilliant. Obviously, the mutiny we've talked about. But it was definitely, you know, Ike and Moore made the right decision when they said, look, we feel the show can sustain for four seasons and let's go out on a high, as opposed to something, you know, like Lost. By the time you get to season seven, I mean, that season is just a total mess. And it's sad because that show for six seasons was so brilliant and so, you know, and yet by not, you know, I've said this before, by not sticking the landing, it in a way negates everything that came before. So when you talk on one hand about the great TV series of all time, people don't mention Lost. And not because it doesn't deserve to be mentioned, but largely because it was botched at the very end.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, Rocky won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 76, and then Rocky V comes out, and everybody hates Rocky.
Right. But, you know, the great thing is it's all secular. This has all happened before, it all happened again. And then by the time you get to Rocky Balboa and to Creed, you know, everybody falls in love with Rocky again. So there you have it. So that's great. Well, listen, I have to say, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about Galactica. And you and I are going to be continuing the conversation at the New York Comic Con on where we'll be participating in New York Comic Con Presents on Thursday, October 4th, I believe, where we'll be talking about 40 years of Battlestar Galactica from A to Dr. Z. And I'm really excited about that. You know, we spoke about Star Trek last year to a packed house and got some great questions and had a really wonderful conversation about that, and Buffy as well. We'll be doing that. And then, of course, on Friday, Chris Parnell from Sony Pictures Television and myself will be interviewing Ron Moore live on stage as part of a 90-minute masterclass. Tickets are on sale for that as well. And, of course, So Say We All is on sale wherever fine books are sold, along with our previous volumes, Slayers and Vampires, devoted to Buffy and Angel. And, of course, the 50-Year Mission, Volume 1 and Volume 2, about the first 25 years and second 25 years of Star Trek, also available. And, you know, I'm equally proud, if not more so, of those brilliant two Star Trek volumes where we set out to write the greatest book ever written about Star Trek. And with all undue modesty, I will say we did.
I think so, too. Agreed, sir. Agreed.
Okay, with the possible exception of The Making of Star Trek by Gene Roddenberry and Stephen Whitfield, which is the definitive, looming thing. But, I have to say that, hopefully this is only the beginning of many conversations that you and I can have, having worked together over the years. And we have so many stories about, working on work on these books, and the many, many great stories about celebrities and people that we've worked with. And, covering these great shows of our youth and stuff now. So I'm looking forward to continuing to talk to you over the course of the next couple of months about as the last Starfighters. You're probably one of the last great sci-fi journalists, geek journalists still working. And so I'm excited to continue the conversation in the coming months. But Ed, always a pleasure to talk to you. I guess there's only one last thing to say. Live long and prosper.
So say we all.
You can visit us on Twitter at Mark A. Altman and Ed Gross at...
Ed Gross.
As well as at 50 Year Mission on Twitter. 50 Year Mission Book on Twitter. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you soon.